From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is a special primary night edition of The Exchange. It's tempting to think that the primary season you're in is like no other. Each has its quirks and surprises. Still, it's safe to say this one has been especially surprising. Who would have predicted that Donald Trump would dominate the Republican race, relegating Jeb Bush to the realm of second-tier candidates? Or that a Democratic socialist from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, would rally thousands and come within a hair of victory over Hillary Clinton in the Iowa caucuses? Well, the suspense is far from over. This past week, new dynamics have emerged on the Republican side after Ted Cruz bested Donald Trump in Iowa and Marco Rubio took a strong third, only to falter under fire from Chris Christie in this weekend's New Hampshire debate. Meanwhile, on the Democratic side, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have gone toe-to-toe on issues dear to Democrats' hearts, such as gun control and the influence of big money in politics. This hour, it's a special first-in-the-nation primary night edition of NHPR's The Exchange, and let's hear from you. What were the pivotal moments for you in this primary campaign? What issues mattered most to you, and why? Give us a call. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange at nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for this hour are Dan Bush, digital politics producer for PBS NewsHour. And Dan Bush, it's nice to meet you. Welcome to New Hampshire. Welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, welcome back.
Good evening, Laura.
And also with us from NPR in Washington, Ron Elving, senior Washington editor at the network. And Ron Elving, welcome back to The Exchange. Great to have you as well.
Good to be with you, Laura.
And gentlemen, just to begin, let's turn the clock back to when this whole campaign started. Dean, it seems like it's been really long.
It has been a long time. Maybe a little bit shorter than it's been in other presidential cycles, but we had a lot of candidates start to get into the race in earnest, really kind of late spring and early summer, sort of in the May and June period. So it's been a while.
What do you think, Dan Bush? What's your perception?
It's
longer than ever?
It certainly has been a long slog. And like Dean said, the invisible primary in the last couple cycles has really started earlier and earlier and earlier. So we see candidates beginning to raise money, think about what coalitions are going to build a year or even a year and a half out.
Wow.
So voters are looking at these candidates for a long time before we even get to tonight.
Yeah, and Ron Elving, it's tricky. There's these little mini announcements, and they kind of hold back, don't they, before making that major announcement, because then the whole money picture changes.
That's right. So that they really dance the dance of seven veils when it comes to candidacy. And when it comes to revealing how much money that they've raised, you would normally think that they would want to impress you with how much money they had raised. But of course, they do, but they want to do it at the right time. And they want to be on the right side of the rules, such rules as there may still be.
Well, and let's just turn back the clock to when many of these candidates announced, as you said, Dean, 6 months ago, 8 months ago, and hear the tone of these hopeful early moments on the presidential campaign trail.
I am officially running for president of the United States. And we are going to make our country great again.
Today we stand here and say loudly and clearly, enough is enough. This great nation and its government belong to all of the people and not to a handful of billionaires.
Fighting for fairness and justice and opportunity for the people of the state of New Jersey. That fight has not made me more weary. It has made me stronger. And I am now ready to fight for the people of the United States of America.
And not one of us deserves the job by right of resume, party, seniority, family, or family narrative. It's nobody's turn. It's everybody's test. And it's wide open, exactly as a contest for president should be.
Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead, because when families are strong, America is strong.
I've heard some suggest that I should step aside and wait my turn. But I cannot, because I believe our very identity as an exceptional nation is at stake, and I can make a difference as president.
A mix of presidential campaign announcements many months ago from Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, Hillary Clinton, and Marco Rubio. Again, you're listening to a special primary night edition of The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Dean Spiliotis, Ron Elving, and Dan Bush. And Ron Elving, to you, going back to, you know, hearing those voices from early on, what were some of the big surprises as this primary campaign started to unfold?
The biggest surprise was the first piece of tape that you played, Laura, and that is Donald Trump telling us that he was officially going to run for president. We have been hearing Donald Trump talk about running for president in each of the last three decades. So it's surprising, I think, still to a lot of people that Donald Trump actually got out there and ran for president. And here he is, having finished second in Iowa, a result that he somewhat disputes, and now apparently doing very well in New Hampshire, storming on to a series of states in which he seems to be ahead in the polls, and he is the man to beat. It's Donald Trump and the PAC. And all the other people that we heard that tape from sounded very much like people who have wound up chasing Donald Trump.
Well, and Ron, we're going to have a little fun with you now, because you came on our program in October of 2014, just before the midterm elections. And at the end of the program, we asked you, okay, Ron Elving, you know, NPR senior news editor, let's get your look ahead to the presidential primary that's around the corner after those 2014 midterms. Let's hear what you said, Ron.
Everybody knows the Bush family, right? But the last time the Republican Party won a presidential election without somebody named Bush on the ticket was 1972, 44 years before this next presidential election. And there's a reason for that. The Bush family has really been a point at which the Republican Party could heal and bring together its divisions. And unless someone such as it's a little hard to think of who that person would be right at the moment, but unless somebody other than the people we have named breaks out in the next year leading up to the primaries and the caucuses, maybe Rick Perry or Ted Cruz from Texas, so I'm not betting on that. Maybe Marco Rubio from Florida, doesn't seem terribly likely.
So, and Ron, we're having fun with you, but, you know, in fairness to you, a lot of people thought that Jeb Bush would be the nominee. Go ahead, Ron.
What's up? Somebody did come along and break out, no question about it, and that person was Donald Trump. And at that time, in 2014, I don't believe anyone, at least not anyone that I knew or know, thought that there was a realistic chance that the man would actually get in the race. You remember the Huffington Post in the summer of 2015 said they were going to cover his campaign strictly on the entertainment pages of the Huffington Post. They did not take it seriously as a campaign. And in fact, the last time that the Bush family was not on a winning ticket was a very, very long time ago. So we'll see what the effect of the Republican Party moving on beyond the Bush era, which now seems very much to be over, we'll see what the effect of that is in terms of their electoral fortunes in November.
What do you think, Dan Bush? Did people not take it seriously early on? People meaning, you know, us in the media?
That's a good question. It was difficult at the beginning to see a path forward for Trump. He, from the very beginning, was running such an unconventional campaign, not spending money, which he still hasn't done very much of, not running advertisements, really running on his charisma and his brand. And with Huffington Post and others really covering him from an entertainment perspective, I think there was a sense in the media early on that he was not going to be a very serious candidate. And obviously, a couple months in, we were all proven wrong.
Yeah, what do you think, Dean?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been waiting for him to decide since 1988, I think. So it's, you know, we've been in this place with him before, and he's always backed away. And so when he finally made the announcement, you know, we said, here we go. I don't think anybody anticipated at that time that he would be in this position. You know, really quickly on Jeb Bush, you can go back to December of 2014. And he was very quickly kind of getting his ducks in a row. Remember, there was some rumbling that Mitt Romney might get in, and Bush kind of boxed him out, started raising tremendous amounts of money for a super PAC, even though he delayed becoming a candidate. And I remember at that time thinking, You know, he's making all the right moves, but the two questions were the kind of the impact of his brother and his presidency, and then the second thing was, could he campaign? How would he be as a campaigner in the current environment? We hadn't seen him in many years. I had never really had a close look at him as a presidential campaigner, and I've heard a number of people say, and I agree, in some sense, he seems to be sort of the wrong time for his kind of style of campaigning. Now, if he has a good night tonight, people think he may be able to turn around in South Carolina, but I don't know. So that, you know, those have been the wild cards for him, and it still has not really been put to rest.
Well, and polls have not yet closed in New Hampshire, so
right.
We have no
we don't
results
know.
To report.
We don't know, right.
Right, right. You're listening to a special First in the Nation primary night edition on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're looking back at the arc of this primary campaign that's been evolving over these many months, and we'd love to hear from you, your questions, comments, thoughts. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, gentlemen, I asked you earlier, you know, what were some of the surprising factors about this race as it unfolded? The Trump factor is one of them. Dean Spiliotis, what else sort of came up that we didn't expect as this campaign began in earnest?
Both Republicans and Democrats, or just
Republicans? Let's focus on Republicans first, because that's a big field, and then we can talk about Democrats.
Well, yeah, obviously, I think, you know, Trump was a big surprise, as we mentioned. You know, Jeb Bush sort of not nailing things down quickly, I think, was a big surprise. You know, John Kasich has turned out to be a bit of a surprise. He's spent a lot of time here. He was not polling particularly well, but he's in recent weeks, he's been doing quite well in the polls. I think just in general, the size of the field was a tremendous surprise. The number of outsiders who at one point or another either got or still have traction, and that, you know, Carly Fiorina, Ben Carson, Donald Trump, and just kind of the sort of intensity of that particular race, I think, has been really unusual.
What do you think, Dan? Surprises?
Yeah, I would add to that probably Ted Cruz. We haven't seen a candidate quite like him from the right. There are questions about his ability to organize and fundraise heading into this race. As it turns out, not only is he an expert debater and somebody whose rhetoric really appeals to conservative primary voters, but he's actually, as it turns out, an excellent campaigner as well. I was in Iowa. A lot of folks there said that he had the best ground game. He's outraised so far on the right everybody except for Jeb. So this is really the first time, at least in the last several cycles, where a conservative has also put together the architecture to mount a credible run. And that, I think, was a surprise to a lot of people.
And a surprise that he won over Donald Trump in Iowa, Dan.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Let's hear a little bit of Texas Senator Ted Cruz on the campaign trail. Now, here he is campaigning earlier this year in Iowa, explaining his approach to combat the terrorist group ISIS.
We will have a president who will make clear we will utterly destroy ISIS. We will carpet bomb them into oblivion. I don't know if sand can glow in the dark, but we're going to find out. And we are going to make abundantly clear to any militant on the face of the planet, if you go and join ISIS, if you wage jihad against the United States of America and try to murder innocent Americans, you are signing your death warrant.
Again, that's Texas Senator Ted Cruz campaigning earlier this year in Iowa. Ron Elving, this became sort of a moment, didn't it? There's sort of key phrases that have emerged during this primary campaign, and this is one of them.
This was the crusader moment from Ted Cruz, and if you are looking for a candidate who might excite a certain amount of anxiety on the part of Muslims and Islamic adherents all over the world, there's no lack of them in this particular field. Donald Trump, obviously, talking about wanting a ban on Muslims coming into the United States. That was a little shocking when he first said it, but according to the exit polls, the Republicans voting in New Hampshire today have said 66% of them that they would favor a ban on all Muslims coming into the United States, at least a temporary one, until, as Donald Trump says, we can figure out what's going on.
Well, Dean, I'd love your thoughts, too, on how this whole issue of sort of national security, terrorism, and immigration got folded together in this Republican primary campaign.
It really did, and there have been sort of two very powerful currents among conservatives. All you need is to spend a few minutes listening to conservative talk radio, and these are both terrorism and immigration are issues that have animated those voters for some time now. And you know, there was a time, you know, a few years ago where it seemed like the Republican Party was you know, slowly becoming a little bit less hawkish and kind of moving a little bit more towards Rand Paul and his father Ron Paul, who are a little bit more isolationist. But then we've had the uptick in these terrorist acts and the very graphic beheadings and the rise of ISIS, and now we've sort of swung back to, as we heard in the sound from Ted Cruz, a much more hawkish stance. Some candidates even suggesting that they'd be willing to put troops back into Iraq and to fight in Syria as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Dan Bush, you said you were in Iowa. Rand Paul, as Dean said, did have that more, well, he wasn't isolationist, but he was definitely not as willing to intervene as some other candidates, and that didn't turn out so well for him in Iowa.
Yeah, we were talking about sort of the arc of the race, and you go back about a year, Rand was the most interesting man in politics, or at least on the Republican side. And there was a lot of interest around him as sort of a new conservative figure that could bridge the gap between conservatives and moderates, maybe even some Democrats on foreign policy. But the moment that the race took a sharp turn to the right on national security around the San Bernardino attacks and the Paris attacks as well, and suddenly became much more of a hawkish foreign policy election, suddenly Rand was out in the cold and his views really didn't sync up at all with primary voters.
Yeah, so when we will turn our attention, by the way, to the Democrats in a couple minutes. You're listening to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're taking some time to look back at the primary campaign season over the past year, how it has evolved, some of the issues that have come to the fore and then receded. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join our conversation. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, since we're talking about it, here is Donald Trump reading a statement issued by his campaign office in early December after the Paris and San Bernardino attacks.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on. You have no choice.
Again, Donald Trump talking about Muslims, saying we need to hold off on people of the Muslim faith coming into this country. Boy, Ron Elving, this is another moment, wasn't it, in this primary campaign on the Republican side?
Yes, it was. And it was a time when I think a lot of people thought, oh, well, that's it. Now Donald Trump has gone too far. But then it was the 7th or 8th or 9th or 10th in a series of things that he has said throughout the year, whether it was in reference to Megyn Kelly or whether it was in reference to Muslims entering the United States. He has repeatedly used language and gone there in the expression of our time that most candidates in the past would have shrunk from. And this has, of course, been true in just the last 24, 48 hours, where he's been called on by many people with respect to some of the language that he's using at his rallies. He says he's just reflecting the people who come to his rallies, and of course the language that he sees in social media, which is another way in which Donald Trump has really opened a new front for particularly Republican politics in this election, dominating in the social media, being the person that people are interested in social media, and dominating Google searches through much of this campaign.
All right, well, coming up, more special First in the Nation primary night coverage on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for primary night coverage on NHPR comes from your listeners and from Altus Investment Group in Concord, offering securities through LPL Financial, member FINRA, SIPC, and fee-only investment management and planning. More at altusinvest.com. From the Common Man family of restaurants and inns, hosting a murder mystery dinner event at the Common Man Inn and Spa in Plymouth on February 20th. Information at theseaman.com. And from the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, awarding $5 million scholarships each year to promising students in need across the state. Information at nhcf.org.
This is a special First in the Nation primary edition on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're spending the hour looking back at the primary campaign over the past year, how the campaigns have evolved and changed, the issues that have come up, and what the candidates have said. We'd love to get you into our conversation, too. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Dan Bush is with us, digital politics producer for the PBS NewsHour, along with Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com, and from NPR, Ron Elving, senior Washington editor at the network. And gentlemen, let's turn to the Democrats. And just as we talked about with the Republicans, Dean, some surprises on the Democratic side, too. Go ahead.
A big surprise, obviously. I don't think anybody expected Bernie Sanders to be in the position that he's in now. In Iowa, he was just polling at a couple of percent, and he basically had a dead heat with Hillary Clinton there. And even here, I remember back several months ago, or more than several months ago now, talking about the fact that he was gaining in the polls and that he seemed to be doing so more quickly than anyone expected, but that there would be the potential there would be a ceiling on it. At least for now, that doesn't seem to be the case. So he's had a remarkable rise. He has captivated younger voters much in the same way that Barack Obama captivated younger voters in 2008, doing tremendously among them. And it's put the Clinton campaign in a difficult position. I mean, I think they view this as a long game, but this is just sort of an added complication because they themselves have a long history in the state and had hoped, given her win in 2008, that she would be able to repeat again. Now, she obviously, we don't know the results yet, but they have been approaching it as an underdog for the last few weeks.
Yeah, and what do you think, Ron Elving, about so many New Hampshire voters apparently feeling the burn?
We are seeing that 23% of the Democrats in the first couple of waves of exit polls say that they made up their minds more than a month, or rather in the last 3 days. Only 23%.
Wow, late deciders. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it's only half the percentage of Republicans who made up their minds in the last 3 days. That number is 46%. So the Democrats made up their minds earlier, and in fact, 55% of the Democrats said they made up their minds a month ago or more.
So what's the significance of that, Ron, for this Democratic race? Yeah.
For one thing, it's a two-person race on the Democratic side, so it's a little bit easier to look at these two candidates, make up your mind, than it is on the Republican side, where there's a little more contest. But it's also, I think, a reflection of the degree to which the generations have sorted themselves on the question of these two candidates, and younger people have found something in Bernie Sanders that, frankly, many of us did not anticipate they would find in a 74-year-old man who, after all, really harks back to an earlier era of leftism with his talk of socialism and so on, and many of his reference points. As someone said, that he looked like and sounded like somebody who was a folk singing revivalist, if you will, somebody who was an nostalgia tour folk musician showing up for a fundraising event at a PBS station. And this is not necessarily what you would expect the people who are 18 to 30 years old to idealize or to look to for their political inspiration. But that is exactly what's happened.
Well, and Dan, you were in Iowa. How did this evolve in Iowa? It was, from what I understand, a surprise for the Clinton campaign out in the Hawkeye State.
It certainly was. Sanders didn't let anybody forget the fact that he started off in Iowa, as he did nationally, with a huge, huge deficit. And he said 30 to 40 points. Some polls had him even farther behind. So by any measure, his comeback in Iowa was historic. And the Clinton campaign was really hoping for a larger margin of victory, something to give them more momentum going into New Hampshire. And at the end of the day, they had to settle for just barely eking it out. But, you know, let's not forget that Hillary did win, although a lot of pundits said that Sanders was the real winner because he came so close. Clinton still won. And although she is going to lose this race, she still is arguably better positioned in the long run when the map expands to states that Bernie is not going to do as well in.
Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, undecided, independent, undeclared, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you. Your thoughts about how this primary campaign has evolved. 1-800-892-6477. And gentlemen, let's go first to Lee. And Ian joins us from Lee. Hi, Ian. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was kind of undecided for the last 3 months or so because I was a big Clinton supporter along with my family. But what sort of tipped the scale was seeing Sanders' respect for his opponent and saying that he will not run their campaigns as much as the other candidates might be doing, especially during the Democratic debate, the first one, where he was asked if he wanted to comment about the email scandal of Secretary Clinton, and he still said, no, I want to talk about the issues. And so with that, I decided to vote for Sanders in today's primary. So I'm very happy to say that.
So the fact that he was not willing to jump into the whole email controversy made him look good in your eyes, Ian.
Yeah, I really respect that in a candidate when he's willing to say, no, let's just talk about what's going on today in this country. So I really respected that.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for calling in. And Dean, you know, we keep hitting on this. This is another moment that jumped out in a lot of people's minds, including the mind of our caller, Ian.
Yeah, I think by the measure of any recent presidential campaign, Bernie Sanders has been very restrained in terms of going negative against Hillary Clinton. He's talked repeatedly about the respect he has for her. You know, you think about how nasty the discourse is on the Republican side among some of the candidates, and this seems like it's worlds away. It's interesting, though, in the last week or two, as the Clinton campaign has struggled a bit with their position in New Hampshire, they started talking about Bernie taking the high road and his campaign taking the low road. This is her phrase, the artful smear that she now uses pretty much any opportunity she has. And so she's saying, you know, it's yes, Bernie is you know, in public taking the high road, but his campaign surrogates and staffers are sort of fighting aggressively as well. So, you know, that's, you know, all's fair in a campaign. But sure, I understand what the caller is saying. There is just kind of a different feel about him personally as a candidate.
Well, and Sanders and Clinton have displayed a good amount of collegiality, as you said, Dean, early on. But as you also said, there has been growing tension as Sanders has shown himself to be an opponent with real staying power. Here's a moment at a recent debate that shows how this dynamic between the two of them is changing.
I represent, I hope, ordinary Americans, and by the way, who are not all that enamored with the establishment, but I am very proud to have people like Keith Ellison and Raul Grijalva in the House, the co-chairman of the House Progressive Caucus.
Well, look, I've got to just jump in here because, honestly, Senator Sanders is the only person who I think would characterize me, a woman running to be the first woman president, as exemplifying the establishment. And I've got to tell you that...
Again, that's Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton in a recent debate, and Ron Elving, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the most progressive of all?
That's quite an argument. And, of course, there's the difference between what is a progressive and what is a liberal. Many people think progressive is just a word that liberals have appropriated to substitute for liberal because of the perceived blowback from the word liberal. There's some of that, perhaps, but we also see in the exit polls tonight that a hefty, hefty percentage of the Democrats who are voting today are very glad to say that they are very liberal, not progressive, but liberal. So there is some difference between the two terms. It's probably a semantic one that most people don't really care enough to sort out. But what is the difference between progressive liberal when you talk about it in terms of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders? Both of them certainly have been associated with the Democratic Party in the sense of being on the left of the general mix of political views around the United States. But Bernie Sanders has always considered himself to be further left than the Democratic Party. And only now is he running actually as a Democrat because he wants to get a presidential nomination and not just run as a voice in the wilderness.
Well, Dean, this gets to something, what Ron says, gets to something that you've talked a lot about. New Hampshire used to be the home of the moderate Republican and the moderate blue-collar Democrat, and both parties have changed here in the state.
Yeah, certainly the Democratic Party in the state has moved to the left. You think back, some of our recent Democratic governors, Gene Shaheen, John Lynch, even Maggie Hassan to some extent. Very centrist. They're part of the old Democratic Leadership Council. You know, that was Bill Clinton and Joe Lieberman and Evan Bayh. And that was back when sort of being a centrist Democrat was how you got things done in the state. I remember when I first moved here, I asked someone, how do you be a successful Democratic politician? And they told me you need to learn how to work well with Republicans. I mean, that was just the nature. And this is going back over 20 years ago, and it just shows you how much it is. It has changed. And similarly, in the Republican Party, there really are no more, you know, what we used to call Rockefeller Republicans or liberal Republicans, any of those kinds of politicians. They've all been defeated in primaries primarily. So, yeah, big changes. And you know, I know Hillary Clinton is arguing that she's always been progressive, but she's, you know, I'm not, you know, it's not so much whether or not she's flip-flopped or changed, but she is a very different political figure than from what I remember in the 1990s.
Well, again, that's Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University. Also with us, Ron Elving, senior Washington editor for NPR News, and Dan Bush, politics producer for PBS NewsHour. And all of you, let's go back to our listeners. You can join us as well on this special first-in-the-nation primary edition of The Exchange on NHPR, the number 1-800-892-6477. And Pat joins us from Westminster, Vermont. Hi, Pat. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hey, Laura.
Hi. Go ahead.
I'm calling because I've always voted Democrat. And this year, if Donald Trump makes it, he's got my vote and my family's and a lot of my friends.
And so you're in Vermont, so you haven't had a chance
Vermont
to vote today.
No, I know, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Yeah.
To me, he's the most exciting thing that's come along in a long way.
So you say you're a Democrat, though, Pat. Donald Trump's running as a Republican. He's got some conservative ideas.
I know he's a Republican, but I've changed my views on a lot of things, and I'm not for Hillary Clinton. Bernie's okay, but to me, they've been part of that establishment for a long time. We need somebody new in there, somebody with different ideas, and I like Donald Trump's style.
What have you changed your mind on? You said you changed your mind on the issues.
I'm not a big fan of Hillary's. I find her very untrustworthy, and I don't like a lot of the way things are going in the state of Vermont. There's just a lot of things I just don't like, and
I
just find him new and exciting, and I don't like any of the other Republican, you know.
Well, Pat, thank you
for
calling in. Yeah, and you'll get your chance to vote. I'm not quite sure when the Vermont primary is, but Dan Bush, how often do you hear this? You know, I usually vote Democratic, but I'm voting for Trump.
You're seeing that more and more, and it's interesting, going back to Iowa for a minute, there was a question of how many people who said in surveys and polls before the actual caucuses were going to, in fact, vote for Trump. And that question is still up in the air. I was at a high school today where there was a large uptick in new registered voters. Some of the people there were saying that was primarily due to Trump. Another interesting thing about the Trump phenomenon, if you will, that the caller just touched on is the breadth of reasons why people are backing him. In the past, often, and even in this election, if you ask a Hillary supporter or a Cruz supporter why they're backing that candidate, they have a pretty similar list of reasons having to do with policy or personality. With Trump, we're seeing a wide variety, from people who liked his show to people who like his rhetoric and everything in between, which is fairly unusual.
So Donald Trump, Ron Elving, is a political Rorschach test? You can kind of read into it what you want?
To some degree. I think that he has touched a nerve with his immigration positions, although people don't always necessarily name that when asked what they like about Donald Trump. He is certainly someone from outside the usual Washington establishment, outside the usual power structure of either party, somebody who's really just such a breath of different air, fresh or otherwise, that people have to stop and take a look and say to themselves, what would it be like to have someone so unlike all the other people we have ever seen run for president suddenly sweep in and try to do some sort of business in Washington? Could he deal with Congress? Could he deal with foreign leaders? Could he deal with all the different constituencies that a president has to take some sort of cognizance of? Could this be just a completely different approach to breaking up what no one's very happy with, the gridlock of Washington right now?
Well, Pat, thank you so much for the call. Again, the number here on The Exchange for this special first-in-the-nation primary edition is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, 1-800-892-6477. So, Dean, Ron mentioned immigration specifically, and let's dig into that a little bit more. How did you hear these Republican candidates talking about immigration?
Well, the big debate has been over Well, you know, they all talk about building the wall, and Donald Trump, one of his, you know, early famous lines was that he was going to build the wall, and he's really good at building things, and he was going to build a really big wall, and Mexico would pay for it, and he that's become one of his lines at his rallies. You know, there's been a big debate over you know, Marco Rubio and whether or not he originally favored some form of amnesty, and debates over legal status but not citizenship. You know, immigration has been a fraught topic for Republicans in primaries all around the country. And so so this has really been no different. So, you know, a lot of it has been a kind of an intramural debate among Republicans over, you know, who favored what position a year or two ago and whether it included an amnesty or some sort of legalized status. And then, you know, how do you deport 12 million people? All those kinds of questions. So, you know, it's an important issue to conservatives. And, you know, obviously Donald Trump really touched a nerve with his really kind of, you know, very firm position on it.
No, Dean, Marco Rubio was part of that so-called Gang of Eight,
right?
With Kelly Ayotte, our own New Hampshire U.S. Senator.
Yeah, and a number of other senators, and he was one of the ran into a lot of headwinds, and now has subsequently backed away from it a little bit. And as you've seen in the debates, that's one of the things that the other candidates like to come at him for.
Well, let's hear from Marco Rubio. As you said, he's taken some heat for signing on to that Gang of Eight immigration bill. Here he is explaining his stance on immigration at a December 16th GOP debate.
I am personally open. After all of that has happened, and after 10 years in that probationary status where all they have is a work permit, I personally am open to allowing people to apply for a green card. That may not be a majority position in my party, but that's down the road. You can't even begin that process until you prove to people, not just pass a law that says you're going to bring illegal immigration under control. You're going to have to do it and prove to people that it's working.
Again, that's Marco Rubio at a December Republican debate talking about immigration. And Ron Elving, immigration, Marco Rubio, is that going to slow down what some people are calling his Marco-mentum, that he's did pretty well in Iowa and carried that into New Hampshire?
He did quite well in Iowa, much better than expected. Almost caught Donald Trump in Iowa. But again, that was a very different kind of process, bringing out a much smaller proportion of the total electorate of Iowa than this primary brings out of the total electorate of New Hampshire. This is really representative of the state of New Hampshire. And we see that partly because the percentage of people who call themselves independents in the state is well represented in the vote for both Republican and Democratic candidates today. So Iowa, to some degree, needs to be put on a separate shelf, as indeed the Republican Party has done in the last couple of cycles, where the guys who won in Iowa really went, well, not terribly far beyond that. They might have stuck around for a little while, but they were not eventually anywhere close to being the nominee of the party. That could happen again to Ted Cruz, although some people think Ted Cruz will have stronger appeal across the South, and we'll see that when we get there. This Marco Rubio phenomenon in recent days has been essentially the idea that he could consolidate all of the more conventional, more old-fashioned, if you will, establishment Republican vote by defeating the three governors who were still in the race. Marco defeating, that is, Jeb Bush and John Kasich and Chris Christie. Had he been able to do that here in New Hampshire, and he's still in the running with them right now, if he's able to do that in New Hampshire,
we'll
he's going to
We'll pick up on that after a short break. Stay with us.
Support for primary night coverage on NHPR comes from your listeners and from the city of Claremont, New Hampshire. You can learn more about Claremont's commitment to economic development and workforce attraction at claremontnh.com/advantage. From Wentworth Douglas Hospital's Seacoast Cancer Center, where each patient's unique treatment plan is developed by a caring team with you at the core, wdhospital.com/cancer. And the law firm of Raff Young & Pignatelli, serving the business and nonprofit community, national impact, uniquely New Hampshire. On the web at rafflaw.com.
This is a special First in the Nation primary night edition on The Exchange from NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're spending the hour looking back at the primary campaign over the past year, how the campaigns and the candidates and the issues have evolved over time. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And gentlemen, here's a tweet tweet from Patrick, who says the big surprise for me was how terrible Scott Walker was as a candidate. You know, Dan Bush, I'm glad he tweeted because there were a bunch of candidates who everybody thought, wow, they're going to be great. You know, Bobby Jindal and Scott Walker and other candidates as well. What are your thoughts there? Patrick, thank you.
Yeah, Patrick brought up a good point. Certainly, if you go back to last summer, Scott Walker looked like a serious candidate, somebody a little bit like Rubio who could perhaps appeal to conservative voters in early states like Iowa and also the more moderate wing of the party. It turned out that Walker was not prepared to run a national campaign at the end of the day. His big problem was running out of money, and running out of money very quickly, to the tune of around $90,000 a day. He was in the campaign, I think, for only about 60 or 70 days. And it quickly became clear that he just didn't have the organization in place to run the kind of ambitious campaign that he wanted to do. But certainly at the beginning, he looked like a potential top-tier contender.
Yeah, Patrick, thank you for bringing that up. Again, Patrick tweeting us from Manchester, Connecticut. Here's an email from Sarah in Freedom, New Hampshire, picking up on something you said, Dean. Sarah says, New Hampshire hasn't become more polarized, liberal or conservative. The parties have. Most people I talk to, she says, are still very centrist. They just have no candidates to vote for. Sarah, thank you for the email. Dean, what do you think?
Sure. You know, we do have this large block of independent voters, and, you know, there are lots of different reasons why people decide to register undeclared rather than choose a party. The assumption is that people are just kind of unhappy conceptually with the idea of what each party represents, or they find it constraining, or for some other reason decide not to. So, sure, you know, it's for some time we've heard the argument that the two parties, particularly in Washington, are more polarized for a variety of reasons than kind of the country as a whole. And that is part of the problem because that gets played out in our electoral politics as well. So sure. But I still think that regardless, you know, there still may be in New Hampshire a large group of voters who are kind of moderate or in the middle. But the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, as they exist in the state, they have both changed over the 20 years that I've been here, certainly in noticeable ways.
Sarah, thank you for the email. And gentlemen, let's go back to our callers. And Harry's joining us from Port Huron, Michigan. Hi, Harry. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. What an honor to speak to you all tonight. And I'm so grateful for the internet because I get you that way tonight. I'm just so grateful for your primary. Your state is what every state should be in this country. I love how the independent-mindedness of a lot of the people there, and I love how people get on the ballot there. It's easy to get on the ballot, which it should be really everywhere. Your state should lead the nation in this. You can show a lot of people how to do things. And I just also don't ever be ashamed that, you know, a lot of you all have taken heat. I know New Hampshire has.
From people in Michigan.
Yeah, why are they number two? Why are they so early in the process? And I'm glad that New Hampshire and Iowa are early in the process. You folks are winnowing them down. And,
well, Harry, it's great to hear you, especially since you're from Michigan, because Ron Elving, in the past anyway, not so much this time around, but in the past, Michigan politicians have been on the forefront of this anti-New Hampshire first-in-the-nation charge. Go ahead, Ron.
That's true. In 2008, Michigan and Florida ganged up and tried to push their primaries forward and tried to eclipse New Hampshire and Iowa. And that didn't work out so well. The party pushed back. The party said, no, we're not going to count those delegates. And that ended up actually hurting Hillary Clinton rather badly because she won those two primaries. And then, of course, their delegates got pushed aside. So they were punished for having jumped the gun on New Hampshire and Iowa. I think they've learned their lesson. I think people have accepted Iowa and New Hampshire and, to a large degree, capitulated the role that these states have played. And, of course, it'll always be a debate. But I think what we've seen in New Hampshire today, this big turnout, the equal distribution of the independents, and the expression that people are making for the candidates that they're choosing, two people who really have to be considered almost total outsiders. Sure, Bernie Sanders has been in Congress for a long time, but he's been an outsider all the time he's been there. And that is especially true during his years in the Senate.
Well, we've got another caller from outside the state. Jennifer joins us from Madison, Connecticut. Hi, Jennifer. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling concerning the furor in response to Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem's remarks about women who aren't supporting Hillary Clinton. And when I first read that article, I thought, yes, finally someone is, you know, speaking what I've been thinking all this time. Where are young women? Where is the enthusiasm among young women? We are on the cusp of a revolution here, about to put a very highly qualified, you know, woman candidate in the highest office in the land. And I've heard a lot of silence. And I suspect, although I don't know, that there may be some overcompensation happening. Perhaps young women are thinking, you know, I have an independent mind. I'm going to exercise it. I'm going to show that I'm exercising it by electing not to vote for the woman candidate. And I guess I was just wondering what your guest thoughts were about that.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for calling in. And you're right, that has been a big kerfluffle, Dan Bush, in the last couple days. Jennifer expressing some frustration that younger women aren't jumping on the Hillary Clinton bandwagon.
Yeah, the caller brought up a really terrific point, and so interesting that this particular issue seems to be breaking down a little bit along generational lines. So women who are a little bit older, who maybe remember Hillary's earlier career as first lady, or remember, you know, the previous struggles of the women's rights movement, feel very intensely, you know, a desire to see a woman in the White House. But younger women especially seem to have a different point of view. I covered a Bernie Sanders rally last night where I spoke to a lot of young college students. And a lot of the female college students I spoke with said, we want a woman in the White House, sure, but we don't like Hillary Clinton and we're not going to vote for her just because she's a woman. And there is a lot of frustration among older women about that point of view, but it's really there, and it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, Dean, we talked about this when we were on Here and Now yesterday. I'd love your thoughts.
Yeah, I think particularly, as Dan was saying, among the young women supporting Bernie Sanders, I've heard some of them say they felt diminished by the Gloria Steinem comments, that the only reason why they're with Bernie is because that's where the boys are, and they felt like that sort of, you know, kind of sold them short in terms of their ability to make a decision. It is generational. It is a younger group of women who are not familiar with kind of the struggle and the history of this older group of women. And it's a difficult balancing act. In the Republican contest, I've heard Carly Fiorina, obviously a woman running for president, say that she just won't use it in the way that Hillary Clinton does. And so there's been a debate about, you know, obviously it would be historic. But you want to be, you know, you want to make the case also that you would be the best president, male or female. So it has been interesting. It really is kind of a, you know, sort of the baby boomers are retiring and getting older, and that the millennials are a very, very different generation.
Well, thank you again, Jennifer, for calling in. And since you mentioned Carly Fiorina, the only woman running on the Republican side, we sat down with Carly Fiorina about a month or so ago in one of our First in the Nation forums on the Exchange. And we asked her about the role of gender in this presidential primary race. Let's hear.
I think two things are going on. One, I think Hillary Clinton would very much like to avoid any discussion of her track record by talking instead about the historic nature of her candidacy. Secondly, I think we have on the Republican side a couple candidates who routinely insult women. As a woman, I find both of those things offensive.
Again, that's Carly Fiorina appearing on The Exchange, one of our First in the Nation forums. So, Ron Elving, I have to ask you about this, too, the gender question on both sides of the political aisle.
I think that Carly Fiorina probably speaks for quite a few women in this instance, where she says that they're offended both by the assumption they would vote for a woman just to vote for a woman, and also by the way that many or several of the Republican candidates speak of women, particularly Donald Trump, to go right ahead and name the man. At the same time, this is an illustration of how generation is outweighing gender. There's no question about it. It does not seem to bother younger women at all that they would choose a 74-year-old white man over Hillary Clinton in the way that that people were not willing to do back when Barack Obama was running against her. This is something that they feel very strongly should not be their burden. They don't see this as Gloria Steinem sees it. They don't see it as Madeleine Albright sees it. They see themselves as a member of a new generation that does not have to bear that particular torch. That, of course, is resented by some older women who say, well, let's see how you feel about it if you lose some of the rights that you have today. rights, for reproductive rights in particular, to the result of a new administration dominated by Republicans in the White House and Congress and in the Supreme Court.
Gentlemen, before we close out, we should talk a little bit about the governors. This is the cluster of three candidates. Dan Bush, I'm going to turn to you first. John Kasich, Chris Christie, and Jeb Bush. What is the role of these governors in this New Hampshire primary, most of whom didn't really play a lot in Iowa?
Sure. We've seen all three of them, especially in recent days, step up their tax on Marco Rubio, who's really their chief rival for the so-called establishment lane. And they've been a foil for him and have tried as best they can to gain some kind of traction in the state. We'll have to wait and see tonight how well a Kasich does or a Christie will do. But primarily, they've served to take votes away from Rubio and haven't been able to dent Trump's lead as much. And we're going to have to see whether or not any of the three of them drop out. So far, Kasich said earlier in the day that he would have to get, quote, smoked in order to drop out. Christie has said he's going on no matter what, as well as Jeb. So it'll be interesting to see how many of them are willing to stick it out, even if they end up finishing third or fourth or fifth tonight.
Ron, I'd like your thoughts on Governor Kasich, who has logged, I think, more town hall meetings here in New Hampshire than anybody else, taking that sort of John McCain mantle from years back. Your thoughts on his position in this group of governors?
John Kasich has invested more in New Hampshire than anyone else, really. Chris Christie may be close behind him. Chris Christie got the endorsement of the Manchester Union leader, and he had some other endorsements as well. But Kasich is really the guy who's put it on the line for the longest time in New Hampshire and didn't really play in Iowa. And he stands to gain not only by surviving, by being in the top several tonight on the Republican side, but also by raising a different way to think about this entire race. Not to think about it in terms of who is the most conservative or who is the toughest on ISIS or who is the toughest on illegal immigration, but to think of it in terms of problem solving, think of it in terms of practical government, pragmatic government, and think of it in terms of who could actually handle the presidency should he actually be elected.
Well, and here in the exchange, we sat down with Ohio Governor John Kasich a couple months ago and asked him about the frequent characterization of him as the field's moderate. Here's Governor Kasich suggesting that he hasn't changed, the party has.
I met Reagan. I knew Reagan. I actually worked with Reagan, okay? He had a big heart. He wanted people to have an opportunity. Now, my mother used to say, Johnny, it's a sin not to help people who need help, but it's equally a sin to continue to help people who need to learn how to help themselves. And we're reforming our welfare programs in Ohio to demand personal responsibility. I'm not going to change to win an election, folks. I'm just not. This is who I am, and changing is not an option for me.
Dean Spiliotis, he's kind of stuck to that. You know, for all the candidates who say, I'm going to run a positive campaign, I'm going to be true to who I am, John Kasich has pretty much stuck with that message.
He really has, and he's grown as a candidate. I interviewed him back, I think it was in May or June, when he was deciding to run, and then I spoke with him again last month. And he really was kind of a changed candidate. He had this optimistic message. He had relaxed. He was very comfortable with voters, kind of quintessential flair for retail politics that I think will serve him well should he go on. And so he was all in here. I think he's done like 106 or 108 town hall meetings. The question for him is going to be, if he does well here tonight, where does he go from here in terms of a place like South Carolina, which we think of as typically more of a conservative place. But it's interesting, you mentioned about, he considers himself a conservative. I was having a conversation about a year ago with New York Congressman Peter King, and I asked him about the Tea Party, about the move of the Republican Party to the right, and he said that those politicians, the Ted Cruzes of the world, had stolen the meaning of conservatism from people like him, people like John Kasich, who had always considered themselves to be conservative. So again, it speaks to this idea that the parties have changed in recent years.
Well, and getting back to our caller, Harry from Michigan, who said, you go, New Hampshire, and love the turnout and so forth. NHPR has confirmed that voting has been extended in the town of Merrimack because of large turnout. So the polls are supposed to close at 7. Voters who are in line at 7 o'clock are being allowed to vote. So I just wanted to get that out there. Gentlemen, we just have a couple minutes left. And Ron Elving, you first. What are you going to be especially watching for tonight among this Republican field and the Democratic field? What are you going to be looking at, Ron?
I don't think there's any reason to expect a huge surprise in terms of who wins. Bernie Sanders is going to win. Donald Trump is going to win. But it's going to be interesting to see by how much of an attitude Hillary Clinton can take away from this in saying, well, we fought back to respectable, or whether she's just going to get obliterated and really have a tough challenge getting back into the game in South Carolina. She should do better there. She should do better in Nevada first. But it's going to be a lot harder if she looks as though she just wasn't able to counter the Bernie Sanders surge in New Hampshire. On the Republican side, the big question is who finishes second and by how much. You mentioned that we have the governors all bunched together, and we do. We also have Marco Rubio in that mix. We also have Ted Cruz in that mix. He seems to have gotten some of Ron Paul's old vote and some of Rand Paul's vote, as we mentioned earlier. So it's going to be a question not only of second, but it's going to be a question of second by how much.
So everybody's sort of vying for the silver and the bronze, as some have put it, Ron.
Exactly. And those medals matter.
Yeah. That's the ticket out of New Hampshire. That's the other phrase that keeps coming up. What do you think, Dan Bush?
Yeah, I agree with Ron. I think that, you know, there's no real surprise about who the winner is, barring a completely unforeseen upset. On the Democratic side, you know, the margin of victory is really what people are going to be talking about tomorrow morning. Was Hillary Clinton able to make it a close ball game? Was she able to get within 10 points, within 5 points? Remember, and some polls have had Sanders ahead by more than 20 points as recently as yesterday. So if she can make it a pretty close contest, that sets her up much, much better for South Carolina, for Nevada, and so on. And then on the Republican side, it'll be interesting to see how well Rubio does in particular, and Cruz, whether Cruz could carry his Iowa momentum to a respectable finish and compete on Super Tuesday when he's going to be facing a very, very formidable opposition, but have a good electoral landscape in southern religious states. And can Rubio carry his momentum from Iowa ahead to South Carolina? So we'll have to see how that plays out.
And who's going to break up from that group of governors as well? Yeah, Dean, go ahead.
I'm always interested in how candidates pivot to the next contest. Candidates who exceed expectations, how do they spin it? Candidates who fall short. I thought what was so amazing about Iowa was Marco Rubio finished third. He got out in front, gave essentially a victory speech, and left town. And that was the story coming into New Hampshire. So, you know, we'll see what happens tonight. If there's a strong second-place finisher on the Republican side, how does he or she pivot out of there to South Carolina? And then on the Democratic side, I think everyone is correct. The margin of victory and how the Clintons deal with a potential defeat.
All right. Dean Spiliotis, Ron Elving, Dan Bush, thank you so much. I really appreciate you all being here. Thank you.
Sure thing.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. Stay with us for more special First in the Nation primary coverage from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy.